forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs. I have a returning guest here on the Finding Genius Podcast. It's Professor Mark Holzapfel. He's in chemical engineering department at Texas A&M. For some reason, he seems to have all these amazing ideas, one after another, and really enjoyed speaking with him about it from an engineering perspective. So welcome back, Mark.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we had mentioned offline, there's an engine that you're working on that is fuel agnostic. Sounds really interesting, the Star engine. So maybe we could start with that and talk about the project and how this idea first came and what's happening with it.
Okay, so when I was in high school, we had the energy crisis, and it really made a huge impact on me. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how to improve efficiency. And I remember when I was newly married, my wife's parents lived in Dallas, and we live in College Station. And of course, we would drive back and forth to see them. And my wife looked into my eyes, and she said, "You're thinking about that engine, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." So it's something that has absolutely consumed me for many, many years. And so what I was trying to do was figure out how to come up with an engine that's much more efficient than the automobile engines that we currently use. You may or may not know that a typical efficiency of an automobile engine is around 20-25%, where theoretically from burning a fuel based on Carnot, you should be up around maybe 80% or 85%. So there's a huge gap between what an automobile engine is actually doing and what theory says it could do if it were perfect. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about how to close that gap. And the way that I came up with was you have a compressor. All engines have to compress air or whatever gas that they're doing. And you have an expander, which all engines have. So the piston in a regular car engine compresses the air and then it expands the hot air. And that's how you get the power. But there's a lot of heat that comes off the exhaust gas that's just goes out into the world unused. As an aside, I've seen some Mercedes commercials years ago where they showed an engine on a test stand and it was revving really, really high RPMs. And literally the exhaust manifold was glowing red. And I think they were showing that for the visual impact. But as an engineer, when I see the exhaust manifold glowing red, that means you're sending huge amounts of heat out the tailpipe, which is why they're so inefficient. And so the thought was, how can I take that heat and put it back into the engine? And so I surmised that basically what's called a recuperated Brayton cycle could do that. And I didn't know that was the name of it at the time. I kind of came up with it on my own and later found out that, yes, people have thought of this before. And this is called a recuperated Brayton cycle. So basically what you do is you compress the air and then you go to a heat exchanger that you preheat the compressed air as much as you can with the exhaust gas. Then you add fuel to make that compressed air really hot. And then you go through the expander. Coming off the expander, they're still pretty hot. And so we put that through the heat exchanger, scrape off as much of that heat as we can, and send off into the world a relatively cool exhaust. So that, to me,
good
made the most...
Good question here, though.
Sure.
In a traditional engine, though, it's not just gases. I mean, it's also liquid droplets of the fuel. So, I mean, you know, phase change is part of the explosion, the decompression of it. I mean, are you sticking with one phase with all gaseous phase, or by definition, things have to go into a liquid phase, in the compression cycle and then in the expansion, again, you're getting a phase change as well.
Well, in a regular car engine, the fuel, as you noted, is introduced as a fine mist, typically like a fuel injection, but you're not really getting the energy from that phase change. You're getting the energy from the combustion of the fuel. So when it turns from gasoline into carbon dioxide and steam, a lot of heat is released. And really what that heat does is it heats up the air that comes into the engine. So the internal combustion engine is just a way of intimately contacting hot fuel exhaust with incoming air.
I thought you would lose a little bit of heat because the heat of vaporization, I thought, was endothermic. I would think by having even small droplets, some of the energy, some of the heat would have to go into vaporizing the liquid component of the fuel. Or is that not right?
No, you're exactly correct. So in the case of a regular car engine, sometimes that cooling effect from the vaporization of the fuel is considered positive because the density of the air is better when it's cold, and in higher density when the air is cold. So you can cram more air into the engine and get more power out of it. So that's, you know, kind of a good factor from the phase change is in a conventional engine, you get more power because you can cram more air in the engine. But it's relatively small effect. If you look at the heat involved with phase change versus the heat involved with combustion, you know, there's many orders of magnitude difference. So the phase change is a relatively modest impact on the efficiency of an engine.
So are you trying to make the compression and expansion the compression and expansion chamber is as adiabatic as possible, maintain every scrap of heat? And then on the heat exchange part, you know, on the exhaust, now you want to make the heat exchange as high as possible, I guess, right?
Yes. So this interesting, so you're really probing thermodynamics. The actual best engine that's Carnot efficient, there's three engines that are Carnot efficient, the Carnot engine, the Stirling engine, and the Ericsson engine. The Ericsson engine, all three of those actually have isothermal compression and expansion. What you want to do is during the compression, keep the gas as cool as possible because it takes less work to compress a cool gas. And during the expansion, you want the gas to be as hot as possible because a hot gas produces more work. So it's actually the opposite of what you suggested is what you want to do in a perfect engine is have an isothermal that is a cool compression and a hot expansion. So now the problem is that in any sort of reasonable sized engine, there's not enough time in the compression and the expansion to keep them isothermal. So we kind of cheat, if you will, by spraying atomized liquid water into the compressor. And so that phase change of water going from liquid water to steam or vapor in the compressor keeps it cool, and it simulates an Ericsson cycle. So that actually is one of the tricks to improving the efficiency. So it's not so much the vaporization of the fuel, which you were talking about before, it's evaporation of water that keeps the compression cool. And that has a fairly big impact on improving the overall efficiency of the engine.
You're taking the heat out of the engine during the compression cycle with the water, and just with the external material that's surrounding the compression chamber, and then you're adding it back after the expansion phase or during the expansion phase? Is the heat hot enough, or the heat that comes off enough to improve the efficiency of the expansion phase?
Yes. So after the combustion of the fuel, the gas is really, really hot. And what we simply do is extract as much energy out of that as we can in the form of work so that the gas coming out of the expander is not so hot that it damages the heat exchanger. So there's, in theory, you could do what's called interwarming between the expansion stages. You just do a little bit of expansion, reheat that gas, expand it some more, reheat that gas. And that would get you really close to the Ericsson cycle. In other words, if you spray water into the compression and do reheats on the expansion, you'll get really, really close to Carnot efficiency. The reason we don't do that is that it takes a lot of machinery to do that. To have, you know, every time you have another expansion stage, there's another machine there. And for the slight improvement in efficiency, it's just not worth it.
Is there any point or possibility, it's just pure speculation, but running the expansion as like with a reflux, you know, like a distillation tower, you can take a little bit of the expanded or unexpanded gas and feed it back into the system with that?
Well, in a sense, that's what you're doing with the heat exchanger. All that energy that's in the exhaust, you're in a countercurrent manner using that to preheat the incoming gas. So countercurrent is almost always, if not always, more efficient. So if you take exhaust gas and blend it in, you're mixing gases of different temperatures. That's actually a lossy thing to do. That in the parlance of thermodynamics, that's called an irreversibility. So the trick to any engine trying to improve the efficiency is you want to reduce the irreversibilities. You want everything to be as smooth as possible. No friction, no turbulence, minimal temperature differences. If you can achieve that, then you're approaching the ideal of the Carnot engine.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
Well, one thing just came to mind. And so in the combustion part of the cycle, I mean, by nature, I would think you're going to end up with all kinds of turbulence at the point of combustion. Is there a way with the shape of the combustion chamber, you know, maybe channeling it through narrow nozzles or just
you often have so many insightful questions. So the patents that first described this engine describe combustion inside of tubes, the ceramic tubes. And when I was in graduate school, there was a dear professor, Churchill, who's actually quite famous. He's unfortunately passed away, but there's even an equation named after him in fluids called the Churchill equation. So if you got an equation named after you, you know, you're a pretty big shot. And he studied these tubular combustors for many, many years. And you have almost no pollution coming out of them. The turbulence that you're describing takes exhaust gas and mixes it with the incoming gas, which means that some of the gas stays in there a really long time and has the ability to make nitrous oxides and other nasty things. So if you have a tubular combustion, it's like in and out. It spends like, I don't know, 10 milliseconds, something like that in there. Not enough time for very much pollution to be made. So in his combustion studies, there was never any undetected hydrocarbon. All of the hydrocarbon burned. And because the residence time was so short, the nitrogen oxides were very, very small. Now, there is some carbon monoxide present, and you have to do a little bit of cleanup on that if you want to be ultra clean. Believe it or not, it's actually possible with this kind of engine that the exhaust coming out of the engine would be cleaner than the air coming in. It wouldn't be quite amazing. I know this would never be done, but let's imagine that California in Los Angeles has a bad day of the smog is really bad. And the government says, okay, everybody, start driving around so we can eat up that smog and have cleaner coming out the tailpipe. That engine would actually be able to do that. So I just find that to be a fascinating possibility.
And what I guess one more thing maybe to add is, what about a pulse injection of the fuel? Pulse combustion, you know, maybe you have inlets for the fuel along the length of, let's say, a long, you know, cylinder along these cylinders. So at different points, you're getting a pulse of more material to combust.
That's an interesting idea. I've never thought about it. The way he introduced the fuel was that the inlet to the tube in a continuous stream, both the air and the fuel were introduced continuously. And one of the features of this ceramic tube is that just imagine that the tube is a foot long, which is typically about how long they were. In about the first 2 or 3 inches, the air-fuel mixture was heating up, primarily because of radiation. The tube was so hot that radiant energy was transmitted to the front of the tube, causing the gas air fuel mixture to heat up. And then it reached a critical temperature, and then bang, within literally like a quarter of an inch or half an inch, the temperature would just shoot way, way up to essentially the adiabatic flame temperature. And then as it continued down the tube, as radiant energy was leaving, the temperature would come down a little bit. So these tubular combustors are just phenomenal. Again, no unburned hydrocarbons, very small NOx, and you do get some carbon monoxide because the temperatures are high, but it's fairly easy to catalytically clean that up after the fact. So, you know, right now, the EPA has put out some very strong regulations about pollution from automobile engines. And the claim is that that's to encourage people to go to electric vehicles. Well, you know, if everybody were driving these ultra clean engines that I'm talking about, it's highly likely that the pollution would be less than what they're targeting, because it's almost pollution free. And so that way, I mean, nobody can complain about an internal combustion engine, in this case, our engine, being a source of pollution. It has the potential to clean the air as opposed to adding pollutants.
I want to ask you about using different fuels, but before that, you mentioned the quantum efficiency. What kind of efficiency difference are we looking at? You know, a typical combustion engine versus the one that the Star engine. How much better is it?
So an automobile engine typically is around 20 to 25% efficient, and a diesel engine is typically 30 to 40% efficient, maybe 42%, something like that. And the engine efficiencies that we're anticipating, I have to make clear, we haven't built one yet. This is all calculations. The estimate is between 55 and 75% efficient.
Oh, wow. That's a huge difference.
It is. And it, you know, if we had these engines, not only would we get the environmental benefits that I talked about with the clean exhaust, you'd also have less CO2 produced per mile driven. And that would have, and our need for fuel would go down dramatically. I mean, we consume about 140 billion gallons of gasoline every year. And so, you know, obviously we have to find a lot of oil in order to satisfy that need. And so we would dramatically cut the need for finding oil. And then I guess part of my reason for passionately pursuing this is that if we're that efficient, then the amount of biofuels that you would need to replace oil would be much less. And so if you look at the amount of land area necessary to supply the biofuels, if we have, you know, very efficient cars, then the land area is really nothing to worry about. Between waste that we have, like garbage and sewage sludge and manure and agricultural residues, they could go very, very far towards supplying our transportation fuel needs just from wastes. So that's why I have pursued this engine for decades, thinking about it, because it would have such profound impacts on our world.
That's really cool.
The challenge is that to build the engine, to turn it from an idea into hardware, is around $5 million or thereabouts to build the prototype. And I just have never been able to come up with that amount of money. So it's a source of frustration to me that, you know, here's this answer to so many of our problems, but there's just a lot of, it's not for lack of trying. I've tried for years to find that
file. Oh, no, sure, yeah.
And it just is hard to come. The logic is, if you go to an investor, they'll say, well, the automobile companies aren't going to change because they're so vested in the internal combustion engines. And then if I go to the government, they say, well, the automobile companies aren't going to change, so why invest in an engine that nobody's going to use? And so I just find it to be extraordinarily frustrating that to know scientifically and as an engineer that there is a practical solution to these problems. But when it comes to the funding, that this just, people don't have imagination, I guess is the point.
Yeah. And some other people could say, well, we'll just go electric. Why doesn't that take care of it? So probably from both sides of the aisle, you're getting, there's no point.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned electric. So I've done quite a bit of thinking about electric, and I actually believe that the ideal car would be a hybrid electric with a star rotor engine. So the electric would be for peak power and maybe commuting, but the engine would be there for sustained power, long duration trips. So I'm not against electric in the automobiles. I'm not so thrilled about all electric. You know, the batteries are extremely heavy. To replace them, you know, after 10 years or whatever is very costly. The heavy weight causes a lot of wear on tires and roads and so forth. In my opinion, the ideal solution to transportation is a hybrid system. I do like the idea of plug-in hybrids. I think that's very attractive, but having enough batteries to go, you know, long distance trips, it just, in my opinion, is not the right answer. And I'll give you a little story. Maybe you'll enjoy this. In Texas, we have gas stations called Buc-ee's. They're really along.
Yeah, I know Buc-ee's. Yeah.
Yes. Either. For travelers, right? So Buc-ee's are for people that are going between cities, and they stop to go to the bathroom and then to fill up. They have this amazing, the cleanest and most wonderful bathrooms you ever see. And they have typically like 100 pumps in order to satisfy the demand. And usually at any given time, they're almost all filled. I mean, it's just it's a phenomenon, Buc-ee's. So I went through an exercise and said, you know, what if we, rather than filling up our car with gasoline, we filled up our car with Buc-ee's electricity. What would that look like? And the amount of power that you need in your gas station is enormous. These numbers are approximate, but they're pretty close. When you fill up your car with gasoline, the rate at which you're putting energy into your car is about 15 to 20 megawatts. So the rate, you know, you typically pump around 8 gallons per minute, maybe 10 gallons per minute, somewhere in there. When you look at the energy content of the fuel, it's on the order of 15 to 20 megawatts. And so you think, you know, at a Buc-ee's, there might be actively at any one time 50 or 60 people filling up. So you multiply that times 15 megawatts, you get up into the hundreds of megawatts of power is going into cars. So if you're going to replace that with electricity, you easily get up into the 150, 200 megawatt range that a Buc-ee's would have. Now, to put that in perspective, in Bryan, Texas, which is, you know, right next to Texas A&M University, there's the Dansby Power Plant, which has been around for years. It puts out about 105 or so megawatts. So we're basically saying take.
But it has to do it for a very long period of time, not just for a minute to fill.
Yeah. That's the other issue is that in order to fill up your car, you have not. It's not a 3 or 5 minute stay. It's you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, something like that. So getting back to the power requirement, a Buc-ee's would take roughly 200 megawatts to satisfy the same number of customers. That would be two Dansby power plants. In other words, take two Dansby power plants, the entire output would have to go to one Buc-ee's in order to satisfy the same number of cars. And then getting to your point about the time, you know, because it only takes 3 to 5 minutes to fill up your car, 100 stations are fine for gasoline. But if you tried to do it with electricity, given the long time, you get up into like easily thousands of charging stations. So you know, the Buc-ee's would have to occupy an even larger amount of land with, you know, literally a thousand cars or thereabouts charging. And maybe it would be good for their food business, right? Because what if it takes a half hour to charge your car or 45 minutes, what are you going to do? What are you going to eat?
So, well, actually, if you have, let's say you have a grocery store that's not 24 hours, even if it is, what if you were to take, you know, a whole bunch of the parking spots and, you know, cars could overnight there? I don't know. I guess you'd have to get them back to their other destination, but I guess if you combined, let's say a Buc-ee's with a taxi, you know, a hybrid taxi place, that might work.
It gets complicated, you know, pretty quickly. You know, when it comes to charging electric vehicles, when you do an overnight charge, it turns out that that's really not too bad, because our consumption of electricity at night is lower than it is in the day, and so there usually is excess capacity in the grid. And so if you have, you know, a pretty significant number of cars charging overnight, that's not that bad. But it's, you know, we expect in our cars that they serve multiple purposes. In my car, I mainly use it to commute back and forth to work and do errands around town. But, you know, a couple times a month or thereabouts, I want to take a trip to a distant city. And I don't want to say, well, I've got my in-town car and then I have another car for trips. I expect all that to be in the same car. So if we have, you know, all electric cars where charging takes, you know, half an hour, an hour, 45 minutes, whatever, that's quite inconvenient. I would be frustrated in trying to do any sort of long distance trip if I have to charge that frequently and for that length of time. You know, in the case of a car, when you charge to be, you know, filled up with gasoline, you typically get 500 miles or 600 miles, something like that. But when you fill up an electric car, you don't get that much. You maybe get 300 or something like that. And then it takes a long time to charge. So you have to stop more frequently. And then when you do stop, you have to take some more time. And I time is very valuable to me. And I just would be frustrated with that. And then when you finally get to your destination, you're trying to find a place where you can park and charge overnight. You know, does the hotel have charging and all that stuff? It just, to me, seems like my life is complicated enough without having to mess with that as well. I'm probably not alone. I mean, there is a market for electric cars, no doubt, but apparently it's kind of saturating right now. I think people are kind of pushing back and saying, yeah, I'm not sure that I want to buy an electric car, all electric.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go back to the Star engine for a minute.
Yes.
Because again, you talked in the very beginning about it can use different fuels. Before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, so, you know, I guess crude oil is refined into gasoline. How clean is the gasoline that is produced, especially like, let's say, 87, 89 octane? So if we have like a very sour crude or a light sweet crude, how different will the resulting gasoline be? And therefore, how different will the engine, you know, the miles per hour efficiency of the engine be? How much does it affect it?
Okay, well, thank you for that insightful question. So yeah, crude oils vary quite a bit. We have, you know, this kind of sweet crudes, Texas Intermediate. We've got this Venezuelan, almost like a tar. Well, Texas has refineries that are designed to take the Venezuelan crude. We have, you know, very high tech refineries that can process that crude. Not everybody in the world can do that, by the way. So that's somewhat unique to Texas, is to have these refineries that can handle this really crappy crude. But, you know, regardless of the sulfur content, regardless of the molecular weight, the refinery is going to turn that raw material into gasoline that meets specifications. So gasoline is not a specific chemical. It's a mixture of chemicals that has certain properties, such as vapor pressure, sulfur content, octane rating. And so it, from the cleanliness standpoint, there's pretty significant fuel standards now in terms of sulfur, even with diesel. So we won't have any issues there. Now, you mentioned octane rating. People think that, you know, higher octane gasoline maybe has a higher energy content. That's not really true. The octane rating just has to do with its tendency to knock. Knocking is this pinging that occurs. If the fuel detonates before the piston gets to top dead center, that's bad for the engine, and it hurts your performance, and it makes a lot of noise, and it will destroy the engine if you do it too much. So the high octane is simply to prevent you from knocking the fuel. So as you mentioned and I mentioned, our engine is fuel agnostic. So if you put gasoline in one day, diesel the next day, ethanol, natural gas, it doesn't really matter. All it cares about is its fuel, and it makes the air hot. So that's really a great beauty of this. I guess one of my thoughts is that, you know, diesel engines are critical to trucking. And it, when I look at the price of diesel fuel, it's always significantly higher than gasoline, sometimes as much as a dollar or something like that different. And I was thinking, you know, if we had Star Rotor engines in our trucks, not only would they be more efficient than a diesel engine and cleaner, but you could use the cheaper fuel. So your trucking industry could run on gasoline rather than diesel fuel, so that price would come down. And then there's a huge amount of natural gas in the United States, so you could run your trucks on compressed or liquefied natural gas. That's a very inexpensive fuel compared to diesel. I mean, we could make our trucking industry, everything we buy is trucked to the grocery store.
LNG is huge. America has a huge, you know, it has tons of resources, and the price is very cheap. So could LNG be used?
Absolutely. And I consider, you know, natural gas as kind of an interim solution towards global warming. It has a lot less carbon dioxide emissions per unit energy than gasoline and jet fuel and diesel fuel, coal. So it's a good interim fuel. Now, it does put out some CO2, and I'm not dismissing that, but it is abundant, it's clean, it's inexpensive. And if we wanted to make our nation wealthier by shifting our trucking industry away from expensive diesel fuel towards inexpensive liquid natural gas and having the higher efficiency, my gosh, would that bring down the cost of transportation. So in my view, that would be a good interim solution on the way towards biofuels. It's going to take, you know, many, many decades to get biofuels up and running at the amounts needed to run our transportation system. So what do we do in the interim? I believe that liquid natural gas or compressed natural gas is a pretty good way to have a good transition fuel.
Yeah, but how can the engine use different fuels? I mean, the the energy required to compress various fuels will be different. Energy released upon explosion, the combustion temperature. I mean, just there'll be so many different factors. You know, also the walls of the engine. If you're running LNG and then you switch to gasoline, you know, what residue is on the walls of the engine? How does that affect future combustions? I mean, it just seems like it's not possible.
Well, again, you ask very insightful questions. So the first thing is that if we go with the tubular combustors that I described before, there are no residues. There is nothing left unburned. There's no, like if you look at the tailpipe of a regular car engine, it's black. Why is that? Well, it's because the fuel is not completely burned and the soot comes out of the tailpipe and accumulates. And even you can see that in some diesel engines that the exhaust is black because of the soot. You will not have any of that with the engine that I'm talking about. So that's not an issue. Now, how would you switch from one fuel to another? And you rightly say that they have different energy contents that would seem disruptive. Well, all you would have to do is just have a thermometer coming off your combustor. So as you switch to a fuel, let's imagine that you're first burning gasoline, which is, you know, pretty high energy content, and the temperature coming off the combustor is where you want it. And then you switch to ethanol. Ethanol has about 66% of the energy content of gasoline. And what you would notice is that, the temperature dropped because, you know, the ethanol doesn't have the same energy content. Well, then you just have a feedback mechanism and you say, okay, well, I'll just pump more ethanol in order to get the temperature up where it needs to be. Now, in a Brayton cycle engine like I'm talking about, you have a tremendous excess of air. In the case of a traditional automobile engine, it's called stoichiometric, the fuel and the air is almost exactly balanced so that there's almost no oxygen left in the exhaust. Not so with the Brayton cycle engine. It has two or three times more oxygen than is needed for the combustion. So no matter what fuel you put in there, there's always enough oxygen to complete the combustion process. So the answer to your question is you have a feedback loop. You just measure the temperature coming off the combustor and then regulate the speed of the pump that puts fuel into the combustor, and you can seamlessly go from one fuel to another.
Well, when you do, I mean, what's the lag time where the new fuel would kick in? And any, even if the residue is tiny, you know, any amount of residue would be cycled out of the engine.
Yeah, I want you to get rid of this idea of residue. There isn't any. Nothing survives this tubular combustor in terms of the raw fuel. Nothing, the fuel, the carbon, char, tar, nothing of that type can make it through this combustor. That's what makes it so wonderful. There isn't any residue. Really, the only issue with switching fuels is to maintain the temperature. Now, the thermocouple can have a very, very rapid response, as can a pump. So within, you know, a few milliseconds or so, you can sense, oh, there's a new fuel. Let me change the parameters. And there's so much inertia, thermal inertia and, you know, mechanical inertia, you wouldn't detect it in the engine. It would be seamless. You wouldn't notice it.
What if you had the fuels change depending on the torque and the speed and the load? You know, you're going uphill starting from the stop. Could you have one fuel for that part of it? And then when it senses that, let's say you're doing highway driving or this, I don't know, some other easier kind of driving or going downhill, the fuel switches to accommodate a lower torque, you know, higher speed situation, let's say.
As always, you have really insightful questions. So it would be, I think, impractical to, you know, have multiple fuels on a vehicle, and everything can be accomplished with one fuel. So we don't need to change the fuel. But what you do need to do is change the torque output, the engine, to match what's going on. And that can be done directly in the engine by changing the pressure ratio or the compression ratio. So those techniques we have in our engine to, on the fly, change the pressure ratio of the engine. So when you're cruising down the highway, the pressure ratio might be 2-1. And when you want to climb up a hill, it might be 6-1. So that's one solution. Another solution, as I mentioned before, is that you could hybridize the vehicle so that these surges in power that are required would actually come from the electric system, which is pretty easy to regulate the flow of electricity. You know, that's why people like all electric vehicles, is because they're fun to drive. You can get these surges of power as you know, the going from 0 to 60 in 2 or 3 seconds is a blast, right? So that's, I think, one of the reasons people love all electric cars is they're really fun to drive. And so you could still have that same feature in a car that's fuel powered. And so all your surges and regenerative braking and so forth would be done through the electric motor and the battery pack and the exchanges of energy therein. And then in the case of the engine, it's just a matter of changing the torque output in order to, and having kind of a sustained average power rather than this, the peaks and surges that are so difficult to accommodate.
One more thing you mentioned, you said with the Star engine that the exhaust could be cleaner than, you know, normal inlet air. So what if a part of that was recycled to become the inlet air? Would that benefit the engine? Would there be less particulates and therefore less damage to the engine, maybe cleaner combustion, that kind of thing?
Well, it's actually, you could do that. There's actually, I thought about, for example, gas turbines, which also run with a great excess of air, recycling the outlet air back into the engine, the idea being to increase the CO2 concentration. So one of the technologies I'm developing is, and other people have developing as well, is carbon capture. So you can capture CO2 from exhaust gas, and that way you can continue to burn fossil fuels and not put the CO2 into the air. But in a gas turbine, the concentration of CO2 is fairly low, like 3% or 4% or somewhere in there. And a coal-fired power plant is more like 12 or 15%. So it's easier to recover CO2 at let's say 15% than it is at 3%. So a way to solve that problem is to take the exhaust air and put it back into the engine. And what will happen is that your CO2 concentration will build up. And then eventually you purge it and put it through the capture system. So that could be done. And there's really no reason why you couldn't do that. It is certainly a possibility. I would say for cars and trucks and so forth, they're probably not going to be capturing the CO2 because that system is too heavy. So I think in that scenario, you probably would not do it. But if you had stationary power and you were burning natural gas, as an example, you could say, okay, well, I'm going to make my carbon capture system more efficient and less expensive by recycling the exhaust gas. And that's a very reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, I don't know. Just thinking about every input, every output that could be used to offset the energy requirements, et cetera. I was also going to ask you, so if I'm driving around and it's really, you know, the air quality is like horrible, I would think that, again, the inlet air to my engines, you know, have a lot more particulates, NOx, SOx, et cetera, maybe not substantially so, but that would affect how my engine runs. So that's why I thought also, too, if we have cleaner inlet air with less gunk in it, perhaps the engine would be more efficient.
Well, it depends, right? So anything that's a volatile, you might be aware that the Blue Ridge Mountains, the reason they're blue is because the pine trees are giving off volatiles and they make the air, this haze in the air. So actually, that's fuel. The vapors coming off the trees, for, as far as our engine is concerned, is more fuel. If you're in Los Angeles and you actually do have a lot of volatiles coming off, let's say from, the sources typically would be, for example, when people fill up their car, that you don't get a perfect transfer of your fuel into the engine. The nozzle usually leaks a little bit of volatiles into the air. And so that means there's a little bit of gasoline in the air. For our engine, that's fine. More fuel. So it's not a problem there. At any other volatiles, let's say somebody painted their house with an oil-based paint and the oil evaporates into the air, that's fine. That's more fuel for our engine. So that won't cause a problem at all.
Okay. How does it affect the performance of, normal engines?
I think the concentrations are, you know, pretty low. So if, I don't have exact numbers, but, you know, it's probably something like 0.001% or some really low number like that is the amount of volatiles in the air. But when you put gasoline into the air, it's going to be, you know, like 10% or something like that. So it's, you know, orders and orders of magnitude different. So it's really imperceptible to the power output and so forth of the engine.
Okay. I guess last question about the engines. Why would it take $5 million to make a prototype? Where is the lion's share of that money go?
Well, you know, everything has to be engineered. And then you also have to recognize that usually the first prototype doesn't work quite the way you want it to. So you have to re-engineer it. And all that costs money. So you'd be surprised at how expensive it is to do prototyping. I was looking at a Wikipedia article some years ago. I think it was about Kia or one of the Korean companies that sells cars. And they were developing a new internal combustion engine for their product line. So it's an internal combustion engine. It's one that, you know, it's like we've been building for over 100 years. And they spent something like $500 million on the prototyping. So anytime you do something with engines, it's a lot of money. So frankly, the question you should be asking is, how could you build a brand new engine that's never been built before for only $5 million? And that's the right question to ask.
And I guess, we'd need a bunch of instrumentation, too, to see if the efficiencies are right, what the exhaust looks like, you know, et cetera. So, I guess I'd see why it would get very expensive.
And, you know, there's materials issues that we have to slog through. The temperatures are very high. So we have concepts on how to deal with that, but they haven't been proven. I remember this when I was an undergraduate. I spent a lot of time in a machine shop and hang out with the other engineers who like to spend time in a machine shop. And a student made this comment that has stayed with me my whole life. He said, there's nothing more complicated that we build than engines in
the
mechanical world. I have a friend who rebuilds engines. I love going into his machine shop and looking at them and how he, you know, hones them and so forth. I mean, they're true works of art, right? I mean, they're fascinating machines. It's amazing that they work because these pistons are going up and down and the valves are going up and down and the springs are popping up and down and the cams are spinning and all the crankshaft is spinning at these huge rates. You know, it should fly apart. You know, how could it possibly stay together? And it's because of decades upon decades upon decades of refinement and improvements that we have these amazing machines. It's just they're antiquated. That technology is from the late 1800s. And although modern engines, you know, certainly are different from those built in the late 1800s, the principles are the same. And I believe strongly that we need to move on to a new technology, which is the Star engine.
Right. Well, excellent. Well, I mean, it took quite a bit of time talking about it. So I guess one subject at a time is good, but this means I have to have you back if you're okay with it. But
I'd love talking with you. You have great questions, very insightful, very stimulating. I love getting the word out about the various things I'm doing. I hope the people in the audience enjoy hearing about these various technologies. And anybody's always free to contact me if they have questions. I'm a professor at Texas A&M in the Department of Chemical Engineering. So just look up on the website. You can get my phone number, my email address. So if what I've said stimulates anybody and they have questions, you're welcome to contact me. I love fielding questions.
Excellent. That's what I was going to ask you. So, Mark, thanks again for coming back. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Wonderful speaking with you, Richard.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.